Welcome back to the Fostering Conversation podcast. It's a beautiful day outside, and here we are sitting at a table inside, looking out the windows and eager to begin a conversation with Mark Michael, the executive director of the center in Napanee, Indiana. My name is Brant Nine, and sitting next to me is Mike Schaefer. Mike, why don't you go ahead and kick us off?
Thanks so much, Brant. Hey, Mark, I just wanted to take a second and thank you for joining us today. I'm really, really, really excited about it, really excited to have a conversation with you. Do you just want to take a minute and introduce yourself to the listeners real quick?
Sure, Mike. Thanks for having me today. I appreciate the opportunity to share. For the listeners, quick background. I grew up in Napanee, and I went to grew up in Wakarusa Missionary Church, so I feel like I'm at home right now, sitting up here, although this part of the building wasn't part of my youth. Yeah. And yeah, spent a few years as a youth pastor coming out of college, decided to go the counseling route, and got a master's in psychological counseling from, I don't want to sound too obnoxious, it was a small Catholic university about 30 miles from here.
Notre Dame.
That's it, Brent.
Yep.
Thank you.
Yep.
And worked in mental health for about 8 years after that. Then I went back to a church position. I was the senior pastor at First Congregational Church in Elkhart for 8 years. Landed at Basher Children's Home as their clinical supervisor and therapist. Getting through the lean years of the recession, I ended up running the addictions program there for the residential side. And then in 2014, became the executive director at Family Christian Development Center, the center in Napanee, where you know, we help the families in the community with food, rent, utilities, clothing, medication, immunizations. I mean, we're kind of the faith-based social service agency for the Wanee Community Schools.
Mm-hmm. That's great. Do you want to take a second and just kind of explain what Basher is and what they do for the listeners that aren't from this area?
Absolutely. Basher Children's Home is just outside of Goshen, out in the country. It's a beautiful campus that has a residential treatment program for troubled youth, for lack of a better term. They also have an alternative school that goes from, I believe, K through 12 now. It's been a while since I've had that information. They have a specific program as well for girls who are coming out of sex trafficking and that kind of a situation. So they have a big reach as well throughout the state of Indiana. They do take some kids, some teens from out of state. But for the most part, it's sort of a regional draw where the kids come from. When I was there, we had kids in the addictions program as far away as Vincennes and Jeffersonville and some of those areas. But big Indy, big Fort Wayne, big Gary influence as well, and the referrals and the admissions. So, yeah, they're in the residential side. Kids might be there 3 months. They might be there a year and a half. It all depends on the progress they make and the kind of care and treatment they need. One of the things that applies to what we're here to talk about today and where your heart is they have a foster care program. They recruit and train foster parents and then give them support. And it becomes a nice continuum of care for the residential kids who aren't able to return home for whatever reason, that we have families that, or Basher has families that they can hook those kids up with and get some stability in their lives.
Mm. That's great. So on the podcast, a number of times we kind of talk about, you know, the mental health side of, you know, where foster kids struggle and kind of some of the things they go through. Just to remind some of the listeners, it's, you know, 80% of foster kids suffer with mental health issues. They're 7 times more likely to suffer from depression. They're 4 times more likely to consider or attempt suicide. And I think a lot of that stems from, you know, the instability and the uncertainty in their life and the lack of consistent support around them. So in your work and the things that you've done, can you speak to how some of that stuff affects these kids as they age and how that gets into their mind and causes some of these mental health issues?
Well, we know that trauma affects how a child develops mentally, psychologically, emotionally, socially, and yes, even spiritually. And anytime they move, you know, from one home to another in the foster care system or into a residential program and then back to foster care, or back to their homes, those are deemed traumatic experiences. And every traumatic experience begins to pile up on the previous ones. And you see this repetition of acting out of the behaviors that they are engaged in a way, in an effort to deal with this trauma in their lives. And if they're dealing with the trauma, then their ability to develop cognitively, academically, is greatly inhibited. When I was working with adults in addictions, and I'd be doing the psychosocial history, and I'd ask them, when did you start using on a regular basis? And then I'd do some testing with them. I would see achievement tests that basically showed that their academic and cognitive development stopped when they started using. And if you dig into it, a lot of them, when they were using as kids, it was because of trauma in their life. So it's crucial that we can develop some stability in those children's lives, whether it's in a foster care, whether it's in their home of origin, or even, you know, as awful as it can be, a residential type program, so that they have a chance to begin to catch up with their peers and where they're at developmentally.
Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting thing that you bring up. I think, you know, a lot of people look at, you know, substance abuse and things like that as, you know, well, that's just a stupid choice, and that's, you made a dumb choice, and why did you do that? And I think for a lot of kids that are in these situations and they go through this stuff, it's a coping mechanism. It's how they're getting past, you know, what's going on, because they don't really have another outlet to deal with it, and they're not sure what else to reach for, and that's an easy thing to block it out for a period of time.
Well, let's take a seemingly normal adult like, say, Brent Nine.
Okay? Normal. Thanks.
And I saw construction going on downstairs, and so Brent decides as the helping individual he is, the servant that he is, he's going to pick up a hammer and help the construction guys. And as he's nailing a nail, he hits his thumb, right? He feels pain. Now, what is Brant likely to do with that pain? One, he may put ice on it. Okay, so he wants to alleviate the pain, but he may go take some ibuprofen or some Tylenol or an aspirin, something to dull that pain. Mm-hmm. When these kids are going through the trauma in their lives, they are in emotional and, I'll even say it, spiritual pain. Mm-hmm. And so going to substances, whether it's alcohol, marijuana, meth, they're trying to numb and dull that pain. I had a psychiatrist when I started out in the business that told me once, he had a hospitalization program that was a dual diagnosis. The kid has mental health and addictions issues. And he said, Mark, every kid who has an addictions issue, a substance abuse issue, probably has the mental illness as well. They're covering it up. They're self-medicating in some way. And so the stats that you threw out there, I mean, it fits the model of, they're in pain. They want to alleviate that pain. They may not be able to get the prescription drugs that would help that or the mental health counseling that would help that. Mm-hmm. So they're finding what they can on the streets, the marijuana, the alcohol, whatever they can get their hands on to numb that pain.
Well, and I've spoken to this on the podcast previously with, you know, my experience. I self-medicated with alcohol because for me, it helped turn my brain off. I didn't have to think about stuff. I didn't have to worry about things in the moment. Now, long term, it makes it worse because it just compounds the problem and you're just adding on top. But also, a lot of these kids come from situations like I came from, and both my parents were addicts and alcoholics. So genetically, they're predisposed to this already.
Yeah.
And so when these things happen, it's kind of a snowball effect, and it comes quickly at these kids really, really fast.
Yeah, it gets complicated in that situation because you get that genetic predisposition. You find the comfort and the relief with the alcohol, and then the consequences of the alcohol abuse begin to pile up, and it's more trauma, more pain, more tragedy, and like you said, it just snowballs into a bigger, more complex problem.
So you kind of spoke a little bit about behavior, and I kind of wanted to ask you about that. So like the instability and going through foster care and bouncing around in different placements, how do you think that impacts behavior patterns as children age into adulthood? Because I know for me, you know, and I've talked about this before, I struggled a lot with honesty. I lied all the time. And I don't think I lied to be malicious or to hurt people, but it was my way of controlling the situation and controlling the moment that I was in. I didn't want to deal with problems. So if I lied about it, I could kick it down the road a little bit and deal with it later. I didn't have to deal with it right now. So how do you think that stuff affects kids' behavior patterns as they age?
One of our mantras at Basher was all behavior has meaning. So we want to look at the kid's behavior and try to figure out what is going on behind that behavior. We would put the image of the iceberg up on the screen during training of, you know, you see 10% of the iceberg above the waterline. Yeah. And underneath, we had imposed on there feelings, beliefs, thoughts, needs, wants, all the stuff that's going on inside of a child that we can't see, but we see the behavior. And so I'll take your example. The kid's lying all the time. What's our natural inclination as adults when a child lies? Punish, punish, punish. You know, you're going to tell me the truth. You're going to get in trouble. You're better to be honest. And we're trying to teach that change in behavior. And a lot of times we don't address what's going on underneath there. So the questions we would often ask is, what does the child think? What does the child feel? What does the child need? What does the child want? And can we address those things in order to alleviate that quote-unquote problem behavior that we end up dealing with most of the time?
Well, I know for my personal experience, and I think this is true for other kids as well, I think, you know, the honesty thing started as, because I bounced around so much when I was young, I felt like if I disappointed somebody or if I let somebody down, they were going to give up on me.
Yeah.
And so if I could control that thought in them and that feeling, well, then I'm stable. I'm still there, you know. So you learn that as a little kid, and then it progresses as you age a little bit.
Well, and a corollary of that could be, if I'm going to get kicked out of here, I'm going to be the one controlling when and how I get kicked out.
Yeah.
You know, I'm going to reject you before you have a chance to reject me. I'm going to make it so that you don't want me, but in reality, I'm the one that doesn't want you.
You've hit on that.
Mm-hmm.
That's been your experience a little bit too,
even as an adult,
right?
Yeah, that led to my adult life, and it led to my divorce. And, you know, because I got to a place where, you know, I'd never had a stable relationship beyond four or five years when I was young. So four years, I was like, okay, something's going to happen. So I'm going to make it happen.
That was so ingrained in your psyche that you're going to make it so that.
So I wanted to control it.
You control the breakup.
Because it doesn't hurt as bad if I did it than if someone did it to me.
And one of the things I used to tell kids at Basher all the time is, control is an illusion. We think we're in charge of ourselves, and most of the time we've got all this unconscious stuff that's just driving what we do, and we've got a society that ties identity into what we do rather than who we are. You know, if I keep reminding myself who I am in Christ, who I am in God's love, my behavior gets a lot better. Okay. It's when I think, well, my goodness, I'm this big time executive director. I'm this cross country and track coach. I'm this wonderful father. You know, all these, dare I say, illusions I feed myself of how great I am rather than who I am. Mm. You know, if I can be reminded of that. And so helping kids with that identity issue and where are you really connected and who really loves you and how are you loved can hopefully alleviate a lot of that problem behavior we talk about.
And I've had conversations with so many people at this point, and, you know, there are certain things that, you know, I have empathy for when I see foster kids do these things and I see them lash out, and whether it's lying or whether it's physical, lashing out or any of those things, you know, it's like you said, these things have a root. They have a root cause. The behavior is just the response.
Yes.
You know, what is the root? What's really going on with these kids? And you spoke a little bit about, you know, at Basher, they have a thing where the girls that deal with sex trafficking, and, you know, a lot of these kids come from really, really traumatic situations, whether it be physical abuse, sexual abuse, addiction homes where the parents are not present. They might be there, but they're not present.
Right.
And the living situations are just absolutely horrid. And so how, you know, I think you learn to distrust people from a really early age when those types of things are going on.
Yeah.
And that really impact, I believe that really impacts relationship building for these kids, even at that age, but especially as they get older, because when that sort of stuff happens, you tend to turn inward as opposed to reaching out for help.
Yeah.
What has been your experience with that?
One of the analogies I would use with the kids, and especially with the staff, when we're talking about kids, especially when anger is the only emotion and then the behavior out of that anger is what we experience with them, is let's say you're going through the woods one day and you happen upon a cute little raccoon that is in a trap. You know, his foot's been caught. And just for sake of the illustration, you're the best veterinarian in the world. Who better to help this raccoon than you, right? You know what to do. You know how to take care of it, how to heal it, how to, you know, get it out of its pain. So you go to approach the raccoon. How is the raccoon going to respond to you as you go to him when he's in that trap? He's scared. He's hurt. He's alone. He doesn't know you. And he's going to lash out. You may end up getting scratched before you help him. You may get hurt. And so if we understand that, that anger that we see a lot of with these kids that have been through trauma and move from place to place to place, that anger is a protective mechanism that keeps people at a distance so they can't get hurt more. You know, they don't know if you're the one that set the trap.
Right.
They don't know if you've got the next trap waiting for them. Yeah. And so that anger lashes out. I remember we had this young lady. She came to us when she was 15 years old, and she was angry. And one day I'm sitting at the staff table at lunch, and her cabin's table or her cottage table is across the way. And we hear this ruckus, and everybody spreads away from her, and she's standing at the table like she's ready to flip everybody's food. And watching everybody give her that distance, I thought, you know, Sherry needs some space. She's afraid, and so she's going to lash out in anger. Mm-hmm. So I decided to go up and stand with her in her anger. And she's looking at me, and she's 6'3", 6'4", she's bigger than I am. And she's looking down at me. She's going, "What the are you doing?" I go, I'm just going to be with you while you're angry, while you're at your worst. I don't want anybody with me. Get away from me. And this went on for about 10 minutes of her, and I just calmly, "Hey, I'm just going to be here with you. I'm not going to say anything. I'm not going to do anything. I just want to stand here with you so you're not alone." And after about 10 minutes, she said, "Can we go talk?" And we went off into another room and talked. I don't know if it was a good thing or a bad thing, but she ended up being on my caseload after that. When she left us 2.5 years later, she's almost 18, we found a foster home that fit her. She's sitting in my office just in tears on that last day. And I'm like, what's going on? Tell me about the tears. And she says, "You know, Mark Michael, you're the closest thing to a father I've ever had." Mm-hmm. And I started chuckling. I started laughing a little bit. She goes, "Don't laugh at me. This is not funny." I said, "No. An overweight, middle-aged white guy with gray hair should not be your father figure, you know? You should have somebody other than me, an image different than me in your head. But I'm glad that I'm in your heart." So that anger just helps keep people at a distance, and that's a protective mechanism, as you well know, that we're going to see from kids. And if we can learn to be with them in their anger and not be threatened by it, not be intimidated by it, not be scared by it, give them the space they need, but let them know somebody's there with them that loves them and cares for them.
Well, I think that's such practical advice for foster parents that are going through that is, you know, understand where it's coming from and be present with them in it, because they're so used to people just, "You're too much.
Yeah.
I can't deal with this."
Yeah.
You know, they need it. And it's so funny because we talk about this all the time. It is such a reflection of how God loves us. Yeah. You know, it really is us modeling that.
It's
really how to best reach these kids and best show them, like, "Hey, I care. You know, I might not always understand exactly where you're at, but I care and I love you and I'm not going to stop loving you."
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Because that's the scary thing. These kids constantly feel like, well, they just, nobody cares that much.
I'm unlovable.
Yeah, nobody cares about me that hard. I'm screwed up. I've got problems.
And that language, "I am unlovable. I am screwed up. I am a mess. I am angry." Rather than, "I feel angry," or "I feel screwed up," or "I feel unloved." Mm. It's a minor difference, but I think it's a significant one in terms of identity versus emotions are temporary.
Yeah.
That's going to pass.
Right. We just had a 9-day camp out at Prairie Camp here, which is close to where Basher's at.
Yeah.
And over 170 students. And the speaker was Jeff Kochenauer. A lot of local people would know who that is. And he talked about your feelings and did such a wonderful job. But one thing that he hit on was, just because you're feeling that way, it's real. It's definitely real, but it doesn't mean it's valid. So you can't always trust your feelings. That doesn't mean they're not real.
Yeah.
But just know that your feelings can't always be trusted. And I think that's something to like wrestle with. Okay, my feelings are real, but it doesn't mean they're always valid.
Yeah. One of the things I latched on early on in my counseling career, again, learned it at a conference from a psychiatrist. He said, good, healthy anger lasts 20 to 30 seconds. Mm. You feel it, you experience it, you express it, you get on with your life.
Yeah.
And then he followed that up with, good, healthy joy lasts 20 to 30 seconds.
Yeah.
You feel it, you experience it, you express it, you get on with your life. And he was talking about, you know, being in the moment of living the life where you're at right now rather than the regrets and pains of the past or the illusions and fantasies and hopes of the future. You know, what's going on with you right now? Feel that and experience that and live life that way.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that's one thing that people that are listening that are foster parents or have ever dealt with foster kids, I think that's one thing you'll recognize is these big, giant swings
yes.
that these kids have. It's the really, really high ups
and the really, really low lows.
You know, and that's because they focus so much on the emotion and they're so latched onto that. Mm-hmm. It's not just a momentary thing. That lasts a long time.
Well, and to the shame of those of us in the therapy side of this, we see those big highs, those explosions. We see those lows, and we want to diagnose. We want to label.
Yeah.
We want to give them that rather than deal with the bottom part of the iceberg. We're going to go, well, that kid's manic depressive. That kid's bipolar. That kid's ADHD. That kid is. And then we live with the label, and they have to live with the label rather than who are they?
Yeah.
Who is this child before me, and how do I help them become who they're supposed to be?
Part of that, so stepping back into the education world for a second, and I've been out of it for a couple of years now, but I had a young gal, 10-year-old, who moved in probably second week of the school year, mm-hmm. and she hadn't been in a single school system longer than a year and a half ever.
Wow.
And while she was in those school systems, she was expelled half the time. And so obviously academically, she's far behind. She's been in and out in as far as the foster system and then back with mom and dad and then just mom and just so many, you know, obvious aces against her, right? And there would be times, you know, obviously we were trying to get her tested so that way she could have the accommodations that she needed because she had never been in a place, and we've talked about this before, Mike, she had never been in a school long enough to be tested in order to receive the services that she needed
right.
to be able to succeed and for the teachers and the professionals to meet her where she was at, right? Which it just stinks. Like it's out of everybody's control because they'd pick up and leave or she'd go to another foster family who lived in a different town. All that to say, she was with me for 100 days and we evacuated my room multiple times.
Yep.
I'm so grateful that Wani, introduced TBRI,
mm-hmm.
Trust based, I believe it stands for relational intervention.
Yep.
And that I kind of like that was a part of me anyway. And so in the moment, though, I was just like, let's get her tested. She needs something different than this. But as I reflect back on it and as you guys were talking, I really think it was so good that she had those 100 days of stability,
yeah,
100 days of routine, and it was hard. I had 27 students that year. It was hard when she would flip tables
yep.
or throw things at me.
My daughter had a kindergartner like that one year.
Yeah.
She spent more time evacuating her room or asking mm-hmm. somebody to take him down to the office.
Yeah.
And the support that she needed just to be able to teach the rest of the kids while this right. young man was acting. The other thing I was thinking about during my walk this morning, Brent,
yeah.
one of our first real interactions was with a young man that I was mentoring.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. If you remember him.
Yeah.
And the year before, when he was in third grade, he'd been kicked off the bus so many times.
Yeah.
He'd been fighting in the playground so much, he couldn't go out for recess anymore. He'd sit at the secretary's desk
yeah.
During lunch and during recess. And you and I sat down with him, and we basically said, we're not going to do that this year.
Yeah.
We're here. We're gonna be with you. You know, Mr. Nine's got you in the classroom. I'll be here every Thursday, Friday, whatever day yeah. it was. I came and had lunch with him. And he ended up being the student of the year
yeah.
that year.
Yeah.
But again, just having people who believe and trust
right.
and we're going to be here. You can go ahead and act out. It's not going to chase us away, but giving them that stability.
Right. We're not going to give up on you.
Yeah.
Even when it appears as if you can't stand us, but then, you know, as well as I do, you know, it would be throwing things at me, screaming at me, cussing at me, another suspension.
Yep.
She'd come back, give me a hug, say I'm sorry, yeah. have a letter and a picture for me. And it was, it's the whole iceberg. Yes. And I know it's cliche, but it's so real.
Yeah.
So yeah, I was just thinking about that as you guys were interacting.
Well, I think the other part of that is kids that have been through trauma and been through people giving up on them and been through, you know, that feeling, you push. Mm-hmm. You push to see where you can get and how far it's going to take for somebody to give up on you.
Yeah.
You know, and so that's a lot of those actions and those behaviors that you see is those kids, they're testing boundaries.
Yep.
They don't have a lot of power, but that's the power they do have.
Even kids growing up in quote unquote normal households, they're going to test boundaries. That's part of our adolescent development is
for sure.
How far can I go before I get in trouble?
Yeah.
I mean, I see it with my cross country and track kids all the time, you know, and I've got to be the harsh. Nope, we're not going to do that this way. This is how we do it. I won't go into much detail, but there's a Division I football player right now that I kicked off the track team twice because he could not follow our expectations and our rules and our culture within the track team.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's those boundaries are important, and expecting them to break the boundaries is part of our job as adults that are helping them heal.
Right.
And then being with them, staying with them, being committed to them, and helping them learn through that boundary breaking process, I think is crucial to their catching up developmentally, socially, psychologically, cognitively.
And you know, you talked about people wanting to diagnose early on.
Yeah,
I think you know, in the education world, it's the same thing. There's teachers, and they're not bad teachers, but they're just like, get them out of my room.
Yeah,
let's get them
special needs.
Yes,
ADHD.
Right,
get them on medication. Get something that makes them easier to deal with.
It makes my job easier.
Yeah.
And the reality is you didn't sign up for an easy job.
No. No.
And foster care is kind of the same way.
Like, maybe even more so.
Right. Oh, definitely.
Yeah.
More so.
Yeah.
But it's still a call to serve the least of these.
Yes.
And to protect the next generation. So anyway.
Well, I wanted to touch a little bit from the other side because as a teacher and a psychologist and, you know, on the other side of that diagnosing kids early on, especially nowadays, because we're so quick to diagnose and medicate kids. And I know from my experience growing up and, you know, kids now, they put them at CANS levels and they do different things. And I don't know what it was when I was a kid. That was so long ago. I'm so old now. But anyway.
You're super old, Mike.
Yeah, I'm telling you.
You're still a young pup.
It's one of those things where I hated going to counselors. I hated going to psychiatrists. I hated doing those things because, okay, well, check these boxes, take this test, and then that's what you're assessed as. That's you.
Yeah.
That defines you.
Yeah.
That's what you are. And it goes back full circle to what you said before of, I am angry. I am unfixable. I am unlovable. Well, I have ADHD. I am manic. You're labeling these kids really early on.
Yeah.
And they hold on to those labels. You know, I just wanted to touch it from the other side.
No, that's a great way to describe it. What it's like when we, the professionals, throw the labels out there without a lot of consideration of what the impact of that label is going to be.
Yeah, and then you carry that. And so, yeah, that's crazy.
Yeah.
So I want to pivot a little bit and speak to what you do now with the center and kind of the experiences that you've had with that. And, you know, and this is, you know, Wani. This is not far away, and we talk about this a lot. People don't understand, like, these things happen in Wani.
Absolutely.
We don't like to think they do because we live in a very nice community in a very nice area, you know, and we like to think everything's honky-dory here.
And we have turf everywhere now.
But it's, you know, so can you speak a little bit about, you know, and connecting the dots here with, you know, Basher and those types of kids and those types of situations? And then doing what you do at the center, how poverty affects these situations and how it leads to these things.
We haven't done any hard research or data on this, but I would venture a guess that a lot of the adult clients that we see, say in food pantry or coming for rent and utility assistance, were some of those traumatic kids, trauma affected kids 10, 20, 30 years ago. Mm-hmm. And the fact that it impacts their education and their training and their job searches and everything then that trickles down to they need help with food, with rent, with medication. You know, the last couple of years, and you know, Brant was on our board for a while, I've been pushing, let's get some training and education in place for our clientele. And it's been like Sisyphus pushing the rock up the hill every day. You know, I get it to part way up, and then I come back the next day, and it's back down at the bottom of the hill again. So you and I talked about this downstairs. It's one of those things where I'm like, okay, God, if it's going to happen, I'm going to let you take care of it. I'm going to quit trying to push the rock by myself.
Yeah.
But I think that's it. I think we're seeing a lot of the effects, the longer range effects of trauma with the families that we work with at FCDC at the center. You know, you mentioned this is Wani. You know, we've got turf everywhere. We're seen as an affluent community, but you guys are pretty well dialed in. What percentage of Wani students do you think are free and reduced lunch?
I would venture to say probably close to half.
Okay.
Well, we got 2 out of 3 elementaries that are Title I.
Yep.
Which means over 35%.
You're in the neighborhood. It's like 31-32%. Yeah. We talk about a third of them.
Yeah.
You know, and to give you an idea of how limited we feel our reach is, we have a weekend backpack program. We put 6 meals in a backpack and send them home with the kids that have been identified as possibly needing them. And if it's a third of the Wani kids, we're probably looking at 900 students that could benefit from. We'll have 35 to 40 a week that we're touching with the backpack program. So we know we're just scratching the surface. We're just barely getting to what that real need is. And then to tie it into, you know, who we are as an agency, you know, the first line of our mission is, the mission of the center is to demonstrate the love of Christ. We want to address the spiritual as much as we can, but until, you know, the bellies are fed and the heat is on and the lights stay on, stability, they're not always ready to hear that message of love and grace and mercy, you know.
Right. Well, and, you know, you talk about, you know, the trauma stuff and you know, how that, again, ties into all this. And I'll go back to some of the numbers I've already talked about on the podcast. But so only 50% of foster kids graduate high school.
Yep.
Only 3% graduate college. When foster kids age out of the system and they don't have a home, 84% end up pregnant in the first 2 years.
Yeah.
That's crazy. 84% end up with a kid of their own. So you're just instilling generational poverty. It's a cycle with these people and these families. And if we don't get involved earlier on,
right,
this is what happens. And it keeps feeding it.
Oh, exactly. I mean, we see that generational poverty. And again, that's why I get on my soapbox about training and education is, and I'm not saying get everybody in college. You know, we've got access to CNA training. We've got access to GED completion. We've got access to welding classes, you know, plumbing, HVAC internships. We've got some access that way. It's getting people to take that step toward that.
That's definitely one of the things that Welcome Home is working towards is, you know, setting up skills and trades and life skills for these kids, because honestly, just basic life skills, you know, balancing your finances and things like that are super important. These kids, you know, get to adult age and they have no clue how to do those things, you know, and you don't need to go to college. You don't have to have a formal education like that, but to have a trade, to have something that, you know, you can do and you can rely upon, I think is super important.
You mentioned, you know, balancing a budget or balancing your finances. We've offered a financial management class. And it's fairly intense. It's 6 months, twice a month it meets. And the people who have finished that have never been back to the food pantry.
Wow.
They've been able to get their finances to the point where they don't need our services anymore. You know, and in the 10 years I've been there, we've gone from a busy day in the food pantry would be 30 to 35 people. We had 62 yesterday, you know, on a random Tuesday. And at the end of the month, that's unusual because, you know, we limit it to 3 visits a month for the food pantry so that we can stretch our food dollar.
Yeah.
And to have 62 on that last Tuesday of the month was pretty, pretty exceptional.
Mm. You know, and it's interesting, you know, cause that's great. That success rate of that financial planning class, that's amazing. That's something me and you talked about in the beginning. For people that don't know, Mark was one of the first people I met with when starting Welcome Home and getting Welcome Home off the ground and kind of walking me through those steps and how that looks. And one of the things that we really talked about was, you know, setting people up with tangible assets as opposed to just handing them money and giving them handouts, because that doesn't teach anybody anything. You know, you're actually long-term probably doing more harm than good by doing that, because you teach people to be reliant upon the handout as opposed to giving them the skills to go do it for themselves.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, we obviously we use the food and the rent and utilities and all that to get people in. And then our goal is engage them in those conversations and hear the stories and hear what's going on underneath their, at the bottom of their iceberg.
Yeah.
That if we can address that, you know, I joke with the board, I joke with the staff that, that our ultimate goal is work ourselves out of a job. You know, wouldn't it be nice if, if the center wasn't needed in the Wanee community? Yeah. And I know somebody much greater and wiser than I once said, the poor will always be with you. Yeah. But if we can reduce that number, if we can get that to where the need for social service agencies like ours is lessened, I think that's an admirable goal for us to get after.
So I want to talk a little bit about, you know, not just the financial side, but when Jeff and Diane Martin were on the podcast, they had relayed a story about a woman who was about to lose her child to DCS because she was about to have a baby and she didn't have anybody to watch her older child. And DCS was going to come and take the child when she brought him to the hospital. And they told her she wouldn't give the child back for 6 months to a year because he got placed just because she was having another baby and there was no one around to help her.
Wow.
So how important, if not as important as the financial side, how important is that community side
and
that community poverty plays such a role in this as well?
Well, and I'll take it even closer to home. My one daughter was in San Antonio when she had her first child in the middle of COVID, you know, and her husband was able to go to the hospital with her. And because of COVID, he couldn't go in. He had to wait out in the parking lot until everything was done, and then he could go in and see, you know, the baby and then my daughter. Well, they just had their second child a year ago, but they've moved to Indianapolis area. So we were able, and they still haven't really connected with a community. We were able to go down and watch the older daughter, you know, spend a couple nights, make sure she was okay, take her to the hospital to see her new sister, to see her mom, her dad. But it was, we've talked about that if we weren't 2 hours away, what would they have done if they were still in San Antonio? Who would they have had? You know, one of us would have had to go down there for a couple of weeks to, in anticipation of. So to get back to your question, Mike, that community support is invaluable.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that does my heart good when I walk down to the food pantry on food pantry afternoons is watching the interaction with the clients. They have become their support group. They share information back and forth about jobs, about other resources that are available. When we got ready to move from the old church building that we were in on Lock Street to where we're at now in the old Central School, we would hear people in the old building on their phones on Food Pantry Day saying, well, I'm at the church getting my food. They saw us as their congregation, as their faith community. And I kept telling the staff and the board, we've got to find a way to take that spirit to the new building. We can't just leave it here. And about 6 months after we'd moved in, it did my heart good. I walked by, I heard somebody on the phone, well, I'm at the church getting my food. You know, that's the confirmation I needed. But to see that support. And I'm going to brag about Betty, our office manager, Betty Kinney. And I've told this story to others, so I'm not speaking out of school. She started out as a client of ours and wanted to give back. And so she started volunteering in the food pantry. And from there, we hired her as a clerk, and she was doing all the logistics and the record keeping for the food pantry. And now she's our office manager. And I tell people, she runs the place.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm just the pretty face that raises money, and she really makes sure things happen. But if you stop in on a Tuesday or Thursday afternoon and just sit and watch her, she knows everybody's name. She knows what's going on in their family, in their home. She chats them up. She engages them in that relational connection.
Yeah.
And she passes that along to our volunteers who do the shopping with those clients. And we want to work at that connection. We want to, if they are their community, if we're their community, we want to make sure we keep that solid.
Right. Zoom out for a second here. And I think this is the responsibility in terms of community poverty, right? The responsibility of the body of Christ.
Absolutely.
Is there are so many people who don't have the family resources, whether it's because they live far away or because they don't have anybody. Mom and dad aren't in the picture. baby daddy isn't in the picture, right? It's just me and these kids. For whatever reason, that's mm-hmm. the situation. And we've talked about, like, what can the church do better, Mike? I think there are so many Christians who are doing things in this regard. But there's so many of us who follow Christ who are doing nothing, too. Mm-hmm. And I think that's where we can, maybe we can't always give financially, or we can't always accept somebody into our home in this season of our life, but we can all join and be a part of a community and be hospitable and be a resource.
Well, we talked about with the kids, just being there with them in their worst mm-hmm. times. If we can do the same thing with those people that are, quote unquote, in poverty in our community, at yeah. least be with them. Mm-hmm. Even if we can't do anything tangibly to help them, they're not alone. They've got some connection.
Watch their kids, provide a meal, be that aunt yeah. and uncle that they don't have.
Yeah.
Be the, you know, surrogate grandma and grandpa, you know.
Yeah. Well, and that's, you know, I think it's from day one, I've, you know, tried to drive that point home about Welcome Home is community, surrounding these kids and families in community, you know. And I think sometimes we get so caught up in thinking the only way we can help people is to do these big, grandiose things, and that's just not the case. Sometimes the littlest things make the biggest difference in the world. There are things in my life that I remember that people did, and they're small things, and I'll remember them till the day I die, and whether that be good or negative, you know. And so the small things can really impact a person's life, and you might not even know that you did it, mm-hmm. but it can be such a huge difference to that kid, to that person that you're helping out, to that family that's just weary.
Yeah.
They're
yeah.
just weary. And they're like, I don't know what to do. I'm at the end of my rope. And yeah. then you bring some help to their life and give them a moment to have a break. It yeah. is such an important thing for some people. Cause I think there's a lot of people that are just hanging on.
Well, and for those of us that have had trauma in our lives mm-hmm. and tragedy in our lives, mm-hmm. to do that for others, mm-hmm. can be, and I believe is actually healing for ourselves.
Oh, for sure.
That service heals. Mm-hmm. Not just the person that we're providing that service to, but our own stuff. I mean, part of our mission statement talks about bringing together the resources of our caring community to transform our community. We got to that point in the mission statement development when board members were telling me that if we didn't exist, their friends, some of their colleagues wouldn't have a place to give their philanthropic dollars or a place to volunteer. And I said, tell me more about that. Mm-hmm. And they said, when they donate financially to the center, and when they volunteer for the center, they come to Christmas Jubilee or some of our big events that they help out with, it changes them. Mm-hmm. And I thought, that's what we're about. We're about changing people, whether they're in service themselves or receiving services. It's going to make some difference in a life.
Yeah.
I'm just thinking about Francie and I, who are community-wise, so wealthy, right?
Right.
We just are. Our neighbors will watch our kids whenever we need them to. Or, you know, I think about Archer fell down the stairs and broke his arm, you know, early May. And I picked him up and said, oh, we're going to the hospital. And without missing a beat, we walked the other two boys down to,
yeah.
you know, our friend's house and went to the hospital with just Archer.
Yeah.
That is a resource. That
huge resource.
So many people don't have.
Yeah, for sure.
And, you know, even, you know, both of my parents passed away 5 years ago. Francie's parents, like if we didn't have them, you know, you talked about going down, and they do so much for us so that we can breathe having three boys.
Yeah.
There's so many people out there that aren't doing it with a spouse, and they don't have anybody to help them breathe. And again, you know, we keep talking about it, but that just spirals everything
mm-hmm.
down a certain path.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Well, and it's, I think the danger, you know, with not having community around you and feeling like there's no community is that feeling of isolation. And that's such a dangerous place to be, to feel like you're all alone. Mm-hmm. And because drastic things happen, you know, when you get to that place. I think that's the place where Satan can work on you the most
yeah.
is when you're isolated and things just compound, you know, and they just get bigger and bigger and bigger. And you're just like, I can't do it. I yeah. can't do it anymore.
Yeah.
You know, so I think that's why I feel like it's so important, because I know how it feels to be there in that place.
Yeah. Well, my own experience, when my daughter passed away, mm-hmm. the night of her accident, and I still have these I'll say, recurring nightmares of not just the accident, but every time we came from her room in CCU back to the waiting room, I'd see those double doors open up and there were more people there. And that became overwhelming, how many people showed up to be with us. Even one of my athletes, it was the night of the Jimtown game. And he had been an all-conference defensive back the year before and was runner-up in the state in the 4x100 that spring with us. And I opened the door and there's, you know, Andrew's sitting there like, what is he doing here? You know, he's probably exhausted from the game, emotionally spent. And I'm like, what are you doing here? And he goes, I had to be with you. And that's what it is. That's what a community does is when somebody's going through a tough time, you know, the loss of a child, a divorce, cancer treatment, what we surround them. We surround them with love. We become the embodiment of the grace and mercy that God gives us so that they can experience that themselves. If it weren't for the community support, I don't know if I'd be here. Quite frankly, I mean, there were so many times I felt alone and isolated and kept realizing there's people that love me. There's people that I love. And this community wrapped themselves around Kathy and the girls and me. So if we can do that for that single mom, I mean, if we can do it for a family like ours, why can't we do it for the single mom? Why can't we do it for the family that's struggling financially? Maybe we can't pay their grocery bill, but we can at least be with them and share a meal with them or something along those lines and make it real, make that love real.
Well, and I think, you know, if we do build community around those people, we can make a big difference on these kids that are ending up in the system.
Yes.
You know, some of these kids just are getting taken because their parents are in a bad place in their life.
Yeah.
Right.
And they need help.
Yeah.
You know, and I.
That's the mission of what the Martins do.
Yeah. With New Mercies. Yep. You know, and the thing of it is, most of the time, our pride gets in our way of asking for help.
Absolutely.
You know, and if you're not in community with people, you don't know if they need the help.
Yeah.
So you've got to be there to be able to help. You know,
and
I think that's so important.
Yep.
So, Mark, I want to kind of give you a moment here at the end to, I want to ask you a question to kind of wrap up and then.
Sure.
So with the things that we've talked about and the youth that we've talked about and some of the struggles that they go through, what advice would you give to foster parents and parents in general that are just struggling and having such a hard time? And they're just like, I don't know what to do. And I don't know what to do with these behaviors and I don't know where to go with this. And then I just kind of want to give you a chance to kind of tell the listeners, you know, about the center and just kind of a little bit about more what they do and how to access that if they need to.
Right. No, thank you. The first thing that popped in my head when you said, what advice would I give is I would remind them that they're not alone, that there are resources. Whether it's the agency that's licensed them as a foster family, whether it's a church, whether it's an agency such as ours, that there are people who can be with them. And if we can give them some relief, some breathing room, you know, that they don't have to be under the trauma themselves all the time. The second thing would be understand that kid, that child's behavior has meaning. Mm-hmm. Try to find the meaning behind their behavior and how do you address what that need is rather than focus on the negative behavior all the time, you know, because when we pay attention to that negative behavior, they're getting attention.
Mm-hmm.
It's getting reinforced. If we can dial down a little deeper, we might be able to see that behavior dissipate. That would be the big two pieces of advice I'd give a foster family at this point. In terms of the center, you know, again, we have a food pantry that is open Tuesday and Thursday afternoons from 1 to 4. We don't check income. So, you know, if Brant 9 shows up and says, I want groceries, all we're going to do is make him prove he lives in the Wanee School District. You know, you got your license, some mail, something like that, and you can shop. And it is a shopper's choice. We don't just hand you a box of food and say, God bless you, go be well. We have volunteers that shop with you so that we hear that story. Mm-hmm. What else is going on with that life? Rent and utilities. We'll help a family, an individual, once a year, once a 12-month period, up to $300. But we coordinate with Open Door. We coordinate with the Township Trustees, Salvation Army, to pull together resources to help a family stay stable. That's our goal with that program is we're either going to pay your NIPSCO bill or make sure the rent's covered so that you can stay in place and your kids can have stability in their school, in their community. The medication assistance program. If you're underinsured or not insured for prescription drugs, We have a program to get you set up that way. We have some funds that will buy some prescriptions for you to get started. Helped a guy refill two things yesterday. But then our nurse, Cheryl Stump, is great at finding the long-term solution, whether that's the free reduced stuff through a pharmaceutical company or getting you set up on Medicaid or something in the health market, mm-hmm. an affordable insurance plan for you to get that taken care of so you're not always coming back and depending on us or another agency for your drugs, for the prescriptions. We have a baby immunization clinic that is free immunizations. We get those from the State Department of Health at no cost, and we don't charge an administrative fee like the health department and some other agencies will do. We just give you the shots, make sure the kids are healthy and good to go. It's a little bit of a baby check to make sure that they're hitting some milestones and things like that, but it's not a in-depth one. But we've got a nurse that does a fantastic job with that as well. And we immunize probably 350 kids a year and getting ready for not just their infant shots, but school as well.
Yeah. Oh, that's great. I just want to thank you again for joining us, Mark. It was a great conversation. And just, it's just so important to have all these resources and all this community around these people. So
I forgot to mention, if people want to check us out, thecenternapanee.org. That's our website. And if you need to email me, it's mark@fcdcin.org. You can reach out to us that way.
All right. Thank you so much. I want to take a second before we sign off and kind of give a little update about Welcome Home and kind of where we're at and what we're looking for here in the future. This has been a really exciting process for Welcome Home and me personally. We're at a pretty neat place. We've collected a lot of things, a lot of stuff for the foster closet. It's all in my house right now. We need a place to go with it. And we need a place to go so we can offer some of these programs for the people in the community. We want to expand on some of the support groups that are already existing out there for these foster and adoptive families. We want to be able to house and hold peer support groups for these kids that are going through these situations to let them know they're not alone in their experiences and just give them a place where they can be open and honest with people that are going through some of the same things. We are looking for a building. We have a couple of things in mind, but we need finances to get there, to be totally honest with the listeners out there. So, just kind of giving everybody an update of where we're at. So thanks so much for tuning in today, everybody.
We'd love our listeners to visit us online at welcomehomeyouth.org. If you're interested in assisting Welcome Home with your mission, click on the Get Involved tab. You can also follow us on Facebook and Instagram. We hope today's episode inspired you as much as it did us. And until next time, may God bless you in the days ahead.